And welcome back, everybody. Glad you could join us on this Thursday afternoon. We're almost at Friday. So you heard it on Fox News just a minute ago while speaking to the press today. The White House Press Secretary Karoline Leavitt celebrated President Trump's first month in office, and they are indeed celebrating that at the White House today, saying that it's been a historic start, and she detailed a number of executive orders they're pretty proud of.
Have ended burdensome regulations, sealed the border, unleashed our domestic energy sector, eliminated divisive DEI from our federal government, stopped the weaponization of government, cut waste, fraud, and abuse, reinstituted America First trade and foreign policies, and ultimately restored common sense.
Now, all this hasn't come freely. Pretty heavy criticism from Democrats on Capitol Hill and a lot of federal judges across the U.S. that have taken action to temporarily block some of these executive orders. But they are indeed celebrating some unprecedented amount of work being done at the White House here in the first 30 days of the Trump second presidency. Also, the Senate right now voting on Kash Patel for the FBI director. They're going through the Senate roll call. Again, that is in Senate voting on Kash Patel for the FBI director. A little closer to home here today in our headlines, that Oakland County mother accused of abandoning her three kids, arraigned today on child abuse charges, given a $250 million bond. 34-year-old Kelly Bryant of Pontiac, she was arraigned on three counts of first-degree child abuse. The judge said she believes that Bryant is a danger to the children, and her main concern is that she might try to contact them since they are currently with a family member. Now, if she does post bond and if she's released, she cannot have any contact with her children or any children under the age of 18. She also has to wear a tether, GPS tether. And in addition, if the court finds out she's making calls from jail to intimidate the kids, the judge said her phone privileges would be revoked. Now, if convicted, she does face life in prison on these charges. She's scheduled to appear in court again for a probable cause conference on March 4th. A preliminary exam is set for March 11th. So her court case is now winding its way through the courts in Oakland County. Funeral services held today for those two kids who apparently froze to death while they were sleeping in a van in the parking lot of the Detroit Hollywood Casino. The family hour was this morning at the Triumph Church on East Grand Boulevard. It was followed by the funeral. The mother and three of her children are being cared for by relatives right now. The city of Detroit is making an effort to see if they can find her permanent housing. But right now, this is a very tough day, of course, for that family and for everyone who is concerned about people who are unhoused in the city of Detroit. Michigan Supreme Court Justice Elizabeth Clement announcing today she's going to step down from the court. She's going to do that before April 30th. And the Virginia-based National Center for State Courts website said that she would become its president. So that nonprofit group deals with the most pressing challenges and opportunities facing courts around the world. Governor Whitmer now gets to appoint the replacement on the state's high court. Clement is a Republican, and if the government selects, if the governor selects a Democrat, the party would have a 6-1 majority on the Supreme Court. Internationally today, President Trump and Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky continue to trade jabs as these peace talks forge ahead between the U.S. and Russia to try to end the war in Ukraine. President Trump doubling down on his criticism of Zelensky, and that elicited reactions from GOP lawmakers, world leaders, and top administration officials. Trump accusing Ukraine of starting the war in Russia. Zelensky accused Trump of being in a disinformation space with Russia, and falsely calling the democratically elected Zelensky a dictator. That is something the president has done. Now, earlier this week, President Trump also suggested, again, that the Ukraine started the war, even though Russia invaded Ukraine in 2022. So despite all of this, the U.S. and Russia continue their peace talks in Saudi Arabia. Speaking at the annual CPAC conference in Maryland, Vice President J.D. Vance touted President Trump's negotiating tactics.
When he walks into negotiation, he says, everything is on the table. And of course, that makes the heads explode in the American media because they say, why are you talking to Russia? Well, how are you going to end the war unless you're talking to Russia? You've got to talk to everybody involved in the fighting if you actually want to bring the conflict to a close.
So Ukraine, again, absent from those negotiations in Saudi Arabia. Zelensky saying that his country did not receive the invitation to attend there. And finally, this afternoon, earlier today, Hamas handed over the bodies of four Israeli hostages held in Gaza, the first time the group has released deceased captives. This is since the October 7th, 2023 invasion that Hamas did on Israel. They are said to include the bodies of Shiri Babas, who was 32 when she and her little boys, Ariel 4 and Kefir 9, 9 months, were abducted from their home in southern Israel by Hamas-led militants. That was more than 16 months ago. The two boys have become the most recognizable victims of the October 7th terror attacks. The first return of hostage bodies marks a hugely emotional and somber moment for Israel. This was a very, very tough day in this story as it continues to unfold in the Middle East. So up next here on WJR Afternoons, we've got several great discussions happening today. First, we're going to be talking with an expert out of Wayne State University. Pope Francis continues to be in the hospital trying to recover from a double pneumonia. And we're going to talk with this expert about what might be happening behind the scenes right now in Rome at the Vatican. Also, we're going to be talking with an expert from Michigan Auto Law about distracted driving. There's a scholarship out there that's named after a young woman who died as a result of a distracted driving accident. And he's here to talk a little bit about this scholarship, but also distracted driving and the devastation it causes for so many families. Also, a little bit later on in the show, we're going to have a couple of segments dedicated to our series, our gambling series about online gambling. And today we're going to be talking to a young man who's had to grapple with an online gambling addiction. He started, he's 38 years old now. He is recovering. He started gambling when he was 12. He talked about his parents, in fact, buying him a little like a poker table when he was about 12 or 13 because nobody else in the family had any kind of problem like this. And of course, nobody knew he would develop a problem. But he talks about how insidious it is to have the ability to gamble everywhere at any time. He said to me, the casino's always open. You don't have to put a coat on. You don't have to get in the car. You don't have to drive anywhere. The casino is always open, and that is adding, he says, to the problem of out-of-control online gambling. So we'll be talking with him coming up here on WJR Afternoons. I'm Marie Osborne in for Chris Renwick today. Glad you could join us. We'll be right back. The Holy Father's clinical condition is stable. That word from the Holy See press office today. Blood tests evaluated by the medical staff show a slight improvement, according to this press release that was released today. So while the extent to which the illness presents a threat to his life remains unclear, the Pope's condition is causing a lot of people in Vatican City to wonder what could come next. We thought we'd bring in an expert to discuss a little bit about that, Dr. Jamie Goodrich, professor in the Department of English at Wayne State University. Dr. Goodrich, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you so much for the invitation. I'm delighted to be here.
Yeah, so the Pope could certainly survive this medical threat. There's no question about that. But would he continue his papacy? That's like a question that I've been hearing from a lot of people or wondering about that. Certainly when Pope Benedict stepped down as Pope, it was unprecedented. It happened, had not happened in hundreds of years. But now the precedent's been set, so he has that opportunity to do that. So Dr. Goodrich, does he make that decision on his own, or does he consult other people?
That's a great question. I would expect that he would consult other people, but it will be his decision. He's going to be really, if this might sound strange to say, but he's going to be taking his orders really from God. That's the way that, you know, that the Pope would see it. So he belongs to a religious order known as the Society of Jesus, colloquially
Jesuits.
The Jesuits, yes. Mm-hmm. And they have a method of spiritual discernment. They call it discernment of spirits. So really, when they're faced with a weighty decision like this, they'll be talking to other people, but they'll also be praying on it and really looking for what am I being told to do? What is God telling me to do? What does he want me to do right now? And so that certainly will be the process that he's going through right now, I would say.
Thank you for bringing that up, because that spiritual discernment is so important to the Jesuits. It's at the core of who they are. And thank you for bringing that up, because it's so very important. So obviously prayer is going to be a big part of his decision-making process and all this, if he has that opportunity, or if he's thinking about that. But I just wonder if anyone else, is there a second in command, like they have, you know, at the White House, say chief of staff, let's say, that is his confidant?
Well, he certainly will have confidants at different, you know, who run different offices over there in the Vatican. But it's not quite like a vice president of the United States or something like that.
Right.
So he will certainly have a team of advisors, I would say that. And it's interesting to think about Benedict as a precedent, because I think another important precedent is John Paul too, right? That he held on through Parkinson's. Mm-hmm. He held on through what many circumstances that many people would find incapacitating. And that is because the papacy is a job for life. So when Francis has been asked about this, he said, well, on the one hand, it's a job for life. On the other hand, if I didn't have the stamina, or you know, I was too tired, I couldn't do the level, you know, the work at the level of thought that's required, then I would step down. So I think he's got to be weighing those two precedents there, Benedict or John Paul. And I think that's the tricky part, is that, you know, just to look at Benedict ignores centuries, as you said, of tradition here.
Yeah, but one of the things that you said was, he has to think about, am I capable of doing this job intellectually? Mm-hmm. You know,
right.
Am I able to? I know Pope John Paul II had a lot of physical ailments, but it seemed, from what I read, I mean, who knows? It seemed like his intellect, his mental capacity, acuity was still pretty high.
Right, exactly. And in this situation, we're not seeing the Pope experiencing dementia or anything of that type. This is pneumonia. So assuming that he's able to get over it, he should be able to return to normal duties. And I think what people have to remember, too, is that he did have that lung surgery. This is a particularly troublesome area for him, that if he gets double pneumonia, it's going to hit him harder than a regular person. So that explains the hospitalization and you know, the medical treatment that he's undergoing right now. But, right, I don't see anything in the situation that to me suggests that he would say, oh, I don't have the intellectual capacity to do this any longer.
So
now stamina and fatigue, that's a different matter, but
we'll
have to see how he feels when he recovers. Exactly.
Yeah, which can be very debilitating, especially at someone at his age. Now, you know, a lot of us have seen Conclave, so now we are all experts on what happens at the Vatican. Did you see Conclave?
No, not yet, but I'm looking forward to it.
Oh, you have to watch it. You absolutely, because you have obviously a lot of insight in this area. You have to watch it. First of all, it's so visually well done that it really captures your imagination when you're watching it, because seriously, it feels like you're right there in so many ways. So, but joking aside, I wondered, how is the business of the Vatican actually being done now that the top person is, you know, out of commission, so to speak? How is it being done? Who's doing it?
Right. Well, the Vatican is a bureaucracy. It's a very long-lasting bureaucracy. It's a well-organized bureaucracy. And so in that sense, it's carrying on its operations as it normally would. We don't have the person making the directives up at the top, but he has lieutenants who are running different offices there and are able to continue the day-to-day work.
So I read an article this afternoon about how when situations present themselves like this, Rome is just abuzz with gossip. I mean, I don't know how else to say it. And isn't that one of the seven deadly sins? I can't remember. But that there's a lot of chatter going on. You know, you have to wonder who else could possibly take this job among all the cardinals in the United States. And someone told me yesterday, actually somebody who has a great deal of knowledge in this area, and they said that Pope Francis had the habit of picking cardinals who were a little bit outside the box. In other words, thinking outside the box. In other words, not people who were from dioceses that were particularly large, but people who exhibited the intellect to be able to do the job of cardinal, and maybe were good thinkers, and those are the people he elevated to the job of cardinal. So, I mean, these things are being talked about.
Absolutely. Rome is a total rumor mill anytime we have a change at the papacy. You have to remember that Rome, even though Rome itself is not a religious state by any means, but the Vatican, it has a special place at the heart of Rome. And Romans are very concerned about what's going to happen there because it does affect the city, even though it is not technically part of the city, if that makes sense. But yeah, I mean, it is interesting. Francis has taken his own path in nominating cardinals. And I'm not sure that anybody really saw Francis himself as being a successor to Benedict. He was a little bit of a surprise. Many people have said he's supposed to be a transitional pope. He was a little bit older. Yeah. So after John Paul's term, they wanted someone who would have a shorter papacy. And so I think that was a surprise, and he has put together a cardinal in it that is ready perhaps to give us another surprise. So like you, I'm intrigued. I don't have any favorites. I'm very intrigued to see who they will end up electing. Yeah.
Do you think it'll be Italian? Someone Italian from Italy?
That is a good question. Francis was a surprise in that he was not Italian, but of course his parents were Italian. So he had that, you know, he can speak Italian fluently. And I do think that is very important, just given the location of Vatican City, given the fact that Italian is going to be the first language for most of the people who are working there. That has to be a consideration, certainly, as they're thinking about it.
Wow.
Yeah, that's an interesting point.
Mm-hmm. Well, the speculation continues, and we absolutely wish Pope Francis the very best. Dr. Jamie Goodrich, professor in the Department of English, Wayne State University, thank you for all your insights today. Excellent conversation. Thank you.
Thank you so much. I really enjoyed it.
And we'll continue here on WJR. Michigan Auto Law will be awarding $5,000 in scholarships to four Michigan high school juniors and seniors through their 2025 Kelsey's Law Distracted Driving Awareness Scholarship. We thought this was a good cause. We want to invite in Brandon Hewitt, attorney and COO of Michigan Auto Law. Hi, Brandon. Glad you could join us today.
Hi, Marie. Thanks so much for having us.
Why don't we start with talking about Kelsey's Law itself? What is that?
Yeah, so Kelsey's Law was actually started by a wonderful woman. Her name is Bonnie Raphael, and she tragically lost her daughter actually 15 years ago this year to a distracted driving crash. And amazingly, she took that tragedy and turned it into something very helpful for everybody, and that is actually restrictions on teenagers with level 1 and level 2 driver's license on their ability to use a phone while driving. So it's been in place for quite a while now and actually was the basis for the new distracted driving law that went into place for everybody a couple years ago.
Yeah.
But it's been in place for teen drivers for much longer. And it's, I think, saved a lot of lives.
Tell us what the law is for teens, and then tell us what the law is for everyone else.
So for teens with level 1 or level 2 licenses, that's either a permit or kind of that first graduated license that they get after their permit. Basically, teens can't use cell phones at all. No texting, obviously, but no talking on the phone either. It doesn't matter if it's a handheld or if it's through Bluetooth. It differs slightly, obviously, from the new distracted driving law that applies to all drivers. And that, in a nutshell, is that all drivers in Michigan cannot use handheld devices. You still can talk on your phone through a Bluetooth-connected piece in your car. But you just can't use a handheld device. But for teenage drivers on these level 1 and level 2 licenses, they cannot talk or, use the phone at all.
Well, you're an attorney. I know you've had cases like this. Tell us about some of those cases. I mean, of course, without giving anybody's identity away, but tell us a little bit about those cases.
Not really, Marie. It's too often. Actually, it's really the number one question our clients ask us when they call us is, you know, they had to have been distracted, right? Please investigate and find out if they were distracted, because some of these crashes don't make sense otherwise, right? You know, why did they just run right into the back of me, right? Or why did they blow the stop sign? Or why did they run the red light? Most of the time, it's because people just plain and simple aren't paying attention. And what we're seeing, unfortunately, you know, as cars get safer, certainly, you know, we have all these crash avoidance technologies and, you know, artificial intelligence driving features and all this kind of stuff. But what I think it's really causing, unfortunately, is a lot of drivers becoming too reliant on that technology, too confident, and they think it gives them permission to drive distracted. So we're actually seeing more distracted driving and unfortunate accidents being caused by that. So it's really just a matter of just not paying attention.
We had an MSU researcher on this week. I talked with him earlier in the week. This is the MSU does the research on the number of people who, you know, who continue to use devices while driving. They're the ones that provide that information, right? And he said that the use of driving with a phone in their hands has dropped by about 1%, a person by 1%. So, and they said, oh, you know, that's a pretty good number because it represents, I can't remember how many thousands of drivers in Michigan. But I thought, that's only 1%. And then I asked, this is sort of like when we adopted seatbelt laws, right? It took forever for everyone to decide, yes, you know what, I just have to put the seatbelt on. Today, you would, most people, everybody I know, wouldn't think of getting in a car without putting their seatbelt on. But we're still so far from that when it comes to using our phones in the car.
We are, and unfortunately, you know, I liken it actually more to drinking and driving. Because people just don't see the danger in it, right, until something actually bad happens. And unfortunately, I think this, look, I think this law, the Kelsey's Law for sure, the distracted driving law for everybody, it's a step in the right direction. But what we're still not seeing, at least in Michigan and in a lot of states throughout the country, the penalties just don't match up to the danger that's presented, right? Everybody kind of understands the penalties that are involved in drinking and driving. If you kill somebody, you know, just getting a DUI, you see the famous billboards all over the place that it's $10,000, you know, just to deal with the fact that you got a DUI, let alone if you actually hurt or kill somebody. But the penalty for distracted driving isn't there, right? It's a point or two on your license. It's a $100 fine. So I just don't think that the deterrence is quite there for distracted driving yet. And to be honest with you, that's, I think, largely because the legislation, they're people too. And the sad fact is that they don't want to put down their phones either. And it's just this addiction to having your phone all the time. And there's been a lot of pushback on privacy rights, which is definitely understandable, right? People don't want to hand over their phones to police, which is an understandable concern. But, you know, just even more so, I just think it's the general populist addiction to looking at your phone constantly.
Yeah, guilty as charged, all of us, really. And you are so right about making the comparison to drunk driving. I use the example of seatbelt. Using a seatbelt, if I don't use one, I hurt myself. I could potentially hurt myself. But when you don't use a seatbelt, but when you go behind the wheel and you're drunk or you're distracted, you could not only hurt yourself, but you could be hurting other people, and you could have disastrous results from that. So you are so right to absolutely point that out. So let's talk a little bit about Kelsey's Law, the Distracted Driving Awareness Scholarship. I know you really engage the students in all this to compete for these scholarships. Tell us how it works.
We love this so much, mostly because it just gets us interacting with students and young people, gets them involved. Because, look, let's be honest, kids don't want to hear from grown-ups and adults lecturing them about what they should or shouldn't do, right? They're going to listen to each other. So peer pressure in this instance is a good thing, where they can talk to each other and tell each other, you know, the dangers. And, you know, everybody does it, but the fact is still that young drivers are still more susceptible to these serious crashes involving distracted driving. So we want them to talk to each other and warn each other about it. We've been doing it for about 10 years now, so giving away a lot of money to high school students in Michigan. Like you said earlier, we're giving away $5,000 this year for a video submission through YouTube. a graphic submission, and a TikTok submission. We'll have a winner in each of those categories, and then we'll also have an overall winner. And what I probably my favorite part about this is that Bonnie Raphael, the driving force behind Kelsey's Law, she is the decider. She's the mm-hmm. final judge for who wins. And so that's a great way to really kind of keep her involved. And I just think it's really special.
I'll bet the videos are awesome.
They get better every year. It's amazing, right? Nothing makes you feel older than seeing this amazing stuff that kids continuously create. And every single year, they just get better and better. And, you know, the technology gets better and better. We got kids using drones now for videos and, you know, just AI, you know, parts of it. And it's just, it's really pretty awesome to see.
Yeah. And it's also pretty clever that you're engaging them in the process rather than, you know, like you said, rather than in a group of adults saying, okay, here's what we have to do. They are the ones who are deeply engaged in the process. And therefore, they're going to take that's something they're going to think about long and hard for the rest of their lives. So give us the particulars. Where can someone apply? What's the deadline? All that stuff.
Yeah, so if you just go to our website, michiganautolaw.com/scholarships, you'll be able to find it there. You can submit it directly to us for our website. It's open to all, as you mentioned, 11th and 12th grade students this year. So if you're graduating in the class of 25 or class of 26, it's open to you. It doesn't matter if you're attending public or private high school, and it doesn't matter if you're looking to go to a public or private college. All submissions we ask to be submitted by March 21st. So it gives us about a month to get all that great creativity in. And then we'll review everything and the finalists. And again, Bonnie will make that decision. We'll announce the winners in April. And then we'll have a group gathering to show off all these great submissions and winners and give out some money.
Well, it's always a good day when you give out money. Again, that's MichiganAutoLaw.com, MichiganAutoLaw.com. Its submissions are being accepted through March 21st, 2025. And if nothing you take away from today's interview with Brandon Hewitt from Michigan Auto Law is this, and you said early in the interview, Brandon, that people, with all the wonderful technology we have in our vehicles now, we are almost too confident and thinking that you're not distracted when, in fact, you really are. I mean, the cars, you know, basically can drive themselves. We all know that. But the fact is, you still need your mind and your eyeballs engaged on the road in order to have a safe trip.
You're still moving thousands of pounds at 50 to 70 miles an hour. So it's a very serious task.
Absolutely. Brandon Hewitt, attorney again, Michigan Auto Law. Go to MichiganAutoLaw.com and have your team put a submission into YouTube or TikTok or graphics through March 21st. It's all about distracted driving, a very good cause. Thank you, Brandon. We're glad you could join us today.
As always, thank you for having us.
And we'll continue here on WJR. So a little bit of breaking news this hour, the Senate voting to confirm Kash Patel as the FBI director. And he is a staunch loyalist of President Trump's and a conservative firebrand. He's going to be heading the agency's, the head of the nation's top law enforcement agency. So again, Kash Patel has now been confirmed by the Senate as the FBI director. Moving on to General Motors. General Motors is shuttering a big factory in Shenyang, China, as part of a company restructuring. So this closure is coming right as the Chinese automakers are gaining market share. And that's leading to, again, these restructuring charges for General Motors. Paul Eisenstein, editor of Headline.News, is joining us. Talk a little bit about what's happening in China. Will it affect us here in the U.S.? Hi, Paul. Glad you could join us today.
Yeah, glad to be with you. I was actually at that factory when it first opened up, what is it, almost 20 years ago now.
And it's a huge plant, correct?
Yeah, it is. And as is the case with virtually every auto plant operated by a non-Chinese car company, it's part of a joint venture. The Chinese require, with only a couple exceptions, that all foreign manufacturers have Chinese partners, which is another issue entirely about what's happened in the Chinese market. But it was an important vehicle, important plant, producing some very important vehicles that included the Buick GL8, which is an extremely popular minivan as well as a Chevrolet Tracker SUV. So some people were really surprised to see that that it was being closed, because the Buick in particular has already sold about 2 million copies in the Chinese market.
The Chinese really love the Buick brand, don't they?
You know, they did. And that's part of the problem. You're seeing a very significant transformation in the Chinese market. Excuse me. From the time GM first opened up its original Buick plant in Shanghai around the turn of the millennium, foreign manufacturers, GM and Volkswagen in particular, dominated China. In fact, the Buick brand was so strong there, that was why GM decided to keep Buick and get rid of Pontiac when it came out of bankruptcy here in the U.S. About 14 years ago. But what's happened is we're seeing a huge shift. All those joint ventures helped the Chinese automakers raise money and learn a lot about building cars. And suddenly, over the last couple of years, Chinese brands are now becoming the dominant players in that market, particularly on the low end. So as part of a big rethink that GM CEO Mary Barra has ordered, they're basically moving away from entry-level products to focus on the high end of the market.
What's the most popular vehicle in China made in a Chinese nameplate in China right now?
Well, among nameplates, and I'd be hard-pressed to tell you this week what the most popular model is, because there have been a lot of new things coming. But what's real interesting is that BYD, which stands for Bring Your Dreams, BYD has become a real powerhouse. It is actually now selling more all-electric models, like the Seagull, than Tesla worldwide, and that's even though BYD does not operate here in the United States. That gives you an idea of how big the Chinese brands have become. I have a story on headlight.news right now, and did it late yesterday, that looks at BYD. The CEO insisted, following a meeting with Xi Jinping, their premier of China, that the company is now a good 3 to 5 years ahead of its competition when it comes to EVs. And I've talked to a number of analysts and some folks in the U.S. auto industry who say, yeah, they really are.
Oh, wow. So how important is this plant to GM's overall production picture? Is it a big part of it? And is it going to affect us here in the United States?
Well, it was a very big part of the GM picture. As I mentioned, they were selling massive amounts of the GL8 and pretty good numbers of the Chevy Tracker. But they just don't think that it makes sense. There's a price war in China. The domestic vehicles, the domestic brands are cutting prices, and that's just putting a strain, particularly on imports, which don't have some of the efficiencies for a whole bunch of reasons. So GM, as you know, posted a pretty big loss in the fourth quarter, and it's taken a $4 billion restructuring charge for that quarter because of all the problems it's having in China. That's why they've decided to shut this plant down.
And how will we at all be affected here in the United States by any of this?
Well, GM only brings over a very limited number of Chinese products through the Buick brand, so there shouldn't be any direct impact. But of course, the fact that GM has gone from having China be its number one market from both the sales and earnings standpoint is a real problem for the car maker, because they really have had to change their business model with China no longer being the cash cow that it once was.
And Mary Barra, as this kind of goes to what you said a few minutes ago, Mary Barra was at an auto conference last week in New York, and she said that the company would focus on Cadillac, Buick, and its premium import brands
In China,
in terms of its Chinese market, because as you said, that's what they're looking at.
Yeah, it was interesting because if you go back not that many years, really, especially before COVID, GM was the overwhelming favorite in a number of low-end segments. They had some products from another joint venture, this microvan that they were selling over there for as little as about $5,000 in exchange rates to the U.S. And that is just not working anymore. All these Chinese domestic brands are coming in, cutting prices, declaring war on the foreign brands. And so now foreign automakers are either pushing up market or, and here's the big problem, in many cases, they are either pulling out or pulling back. We already saw Jeep give up on the Chinese market, and we're probably going to see other manufacturers follow either the Jeep model or the GM model, cutting back or walking out entirely.
Never, ever a dull moment in the automotive picture, is it? Is there, Paul? There's always something interesting to talk about and something big happening in the auto world.
Yeah, it definitely is, and we're going to see a lot more changes. We're going to have to keep an eye out to see what happens with Trump threatening to put in 25% tariffs on foreign-made vehicles. Will he do that on a worldwide basis? Will he focus on some particular countries? And, of course, what happens then? Remember, we export vehicles in large numbers, and we could see U.S. automotive exports shut down.
Paul Eisenstein, editor, headlight.news. Check it out there, headlight.news. Thanks, Paul. Appreciate
Good
your time, as
you.
Always. You're listening to WJR. Stay with us. We'll be back in a moment.
Sitting in for Chris today, Marie Osborne.
A lot going on. We'll get to the headlines in just a minute. But first, we'd like to give you a little sunshine, at least the opportunity to have some sunshine. Sandals Resorts are made of the Caribbean, and we want to send you there. Indulge in an all-inclusive romantic getaway with the one you love for a 4-day, 3-night vacation for two at any Sandals Resort in Jamaica, Curacao, or the Bahamas with round-trip airfare. To enter for your chance to win, text this hour's national keyword, which is luxury. That is the word, luxury, to 95819. For full details and official contest rules, visit WJR.com. All right, you just heard from Fox News, the Senate today voting 51-49, confirming Kash Patel as the new FBI director. Senator Mitch McConnell. Today's his 83rd birthday. He also announced he's going to be leaving the Senate. He did vote a yes, but the moderates, Lisa Murkowski, Republican of Alaska, and Susan Collins, Republican from Maine, voting no. Members of the Senate Judiciary Committee voted earlier this month, 12-10, to advance Patel to that full floor for a vote. And so he got his job today as the new FBI director, Kash Patel. Also today, we are looking at, there's a big story out of AP today about the Democratic Party and who's going to be leading the Democratic Party in the near future. Some believe it's Pete Buttigieg. Now, he's got a decision to make. He's 43 years old, former U.S. Transportation Secretary. He's talking with party officials, Democratic Party officials right now, labor leaders, top strategists. He has to decide whether he wants to return to the national spotlight as a candidate in Michigan's U.S. Senate race or maybe step aside to seek a much bigger role in his party's next as his next presidential nominee for the Democrat. Prominent allies believe that Buttigieg cannot do both. Even as others raise the comparison to Barack Obama, who was elected president just 4 years after becoming a U.S. senator. But could he possibly do this? Obama's former chief strategist, David Axelrod, he met briefly with Buttigieg last week. ahead of a joint appearance at the University of Chicago. And he said, I don't think you can run for Senate in 2026 and then run for president in 2028. I think that would be a very, very hard thing to do. So that advice coming from David Axelrod. As you know, Pete Buttigieg lives right here in the state of Michigan, has been a resident here for several years. His husband is from here. They have two children they love in Traverse City. So that's a big decision. AP saying he is eyeballing, even though Buttigieg has said he's not running for Senate, there's that talk is still out there. I mentioned a minute ago, Kentucky Republican Senator Mitch McConnell announcing that he's not going to seek re-election next year, ending decades-long tenure as a power broker in the Republican Party. Here's what he had to say today.
Representing our Commonwealth has been the honor of a lifetime. I will not seek this honor an eighth time. My current term in the Senate will be my last.
So McConnell again making the announcement today on his 83rd birthday. It follows a series of medical episodes in recent years, including injuries from falls and then at times where he briefly froze while he was speaking on camera. McConnell is the longest serving Senate party leader in U.S. history. He stepped down from his leadership role almost a year ago, being replaced by South Dakota's John Thune. So he's not going to be in running for re-election. Also, at least 58 measles cases have been reported in an outbreak in West Texas, including some people who said that they were vaccinated. The cases are mostly in kids ages 5 through 7, according to the Texas Department of Health and Human Services. Given how contagious measles is, health officials warn that many cases may continue to rise in that area. Measles, an airborne illness, it can cause a rash, fever, red eyes, and coughs. Some severe cases can result in blindness, pneumonia, or encephalitis, which is swelling of the brain. In some cases, the illness can be fatal. There were 285 measles cases reported in the U.S. last year, the most since 2019, according to the CDC data that's available right now. So the Menendez brothers back in the news. They're speaking out about their time in prison, the hardships that they've endured. They say they hope for a second chance at life outside of prison. This was in an exclusive interview with TMZ's Harvey Levin and Mark Garagos. Eric and Lyle Menendez opening up about spending time in separate prisons. Eric thinks back to when his brother got attacked during their early years behind bars.
And I remember the day that I was told Lyle just got assaulted and got his jaw broken. And it was, I'm thinking, he's over there. I'm going through this over here. And at least we could protect each other maybe if we were together. But we were not even allowed to be together. So it was difficult.
And talking more about prison life.
I was picked on, bullied violently, and it was traumatic, and it was continual. And, you know, those are things that a lot of inmates in prison go through. And when they're not part of a gang structure and they come in and they're basically lone wolf, you know, they just have to be by themselves. And prison can be hard, and there's a lot of suffering in prison.
Yeah, prison can be hard. We've heard that before. The brothers were convicted in 1996 of murdering their parents 7 years before that. The brothers are scheduled for a resentencing hearing on March 20th and 21st. That's going to happen in Los Angeles. The hearings had been postponed several times already. First, after the former Los Angeles district attorney pushing for their release lost his reelection campaign, and again, after the wildfires tore through L.A. So again, they're going to be back in court on March 20th or the 21st, in Los Angeles to get another hearing here on whether or not they should go free. A lot of people say they should. Of course, lots of people watch the Menendez brothers show on Netflix where they went back over the case and a lot of questions arising. And in fact, their families, the family members say that they should be released, that they've been in prison long enough. All right, when we come back, we're going to be talking again about our continuing series about online gambling. Today, we get to talk to a person who grappled with an addiction to online gambling, started gambling when he was just 12 years old, and what his life was like, what happened to his life, how the online gambling absolutely tore his life apart. The good thing, though, is he is recovered, and he's now efforting to help others who are dealing with gambling, online gambling, issues. So he's in the throes of that. We'll have more on that when we come back. You're listening to WJR. All in, online, on the hook. We continue our series on online gambling. Michiganders are on pace to gamble $7.5 billion on their phones and laptops this year. And since Michigan legalized online casino games and sports betting in 2021, the state reports the calls to Michigan gambling helplines have more than tripled, and most of the people who are calling are men, young men. So what's it like to have an online gambling addiction? Our next guest knows firsthand. Sam DiMello, welcome. We're so glad you could tell us your story today.
Thanks for having me.
To set this up just a little bit, you are 38 and you work in the technology industry. So why don't you tell us about your addiction to gambling and online gambling? How did it start?
Yeah, so I was the classic age in the United States for the poker boom of the early 2000s. I started gambling at age 12 after I saw Chris Moneymaker win the World Series of Poker on ESPN. It was the first thing that I was ever good at that was cool, you know, in the eyes of my friends. And so I started gambling, playing poker at home games at my house and with friends. When I got to college, I started gambling in the local, you know, native casino that was about 45 minutes away from my college. Throughout all of this time, you know, big warning signs that gambling was going to be a problem for me. I had a hard time setting a limit on the amount of money that I would spend when I was gambling. I had a hard time, you know, setting a limit on the time that I would devote to gambling. But I didn't understand what gambling addiction was. You know, the way that I conceptualized it was, if I'm winning money, that's good. And if I'm losing money, that's bad. And if I lose so much money that I go into debt, that's when things really become a problem. The whole idea of gambling harm, or, you know, the idea that you could get addicted to it, that it could hurt your relationships, that it could hurt your mental health, that it could distract you from things like school, never even entered into the equation for me. So I gambled with these warning signs, you know, all through college, and I graduated. But in retrospect, lost a huge amount of time and opportunity cost, where instead of taking advantage of the opportunity of college, you know, I was spending my time in a smoky casino.
Let me stop you for 1 minute. Where were you getting your money to gamble? I mean, as a 12-year-old, certainly, but even in college.
Yeah. I mean, when I started gambling, it was 10 or 20 bucks sitting around the table. You know, the way that my parents thought about it was, yeah, you know, he's gambling, but he's not out on the street drinking or smoking pot.
So your parents knew about this. Your parents knew about it.
Absolutely. They bought me a poker table for my 15th birthday. I think they saw it as a very, you know, wholesome activity. We were playing cards. And in college, you know, I was playing with money that I had, you know, made working on campus. You know, more of my time went to making that money and then losing it in the casino.
Was there ever a time where the flag went up and said, wow, you're really in trouble?
Yeah, I think during this time, there were many trips to the casino where I would tell myself, you know, I'm only going to spend $100 today, and then I would lose that, and I would go and take another $100 out of the ATM, and then another $100 until, you know, I couldn't withdraw anymore. And then I would borrow money from friends. And, you know, it was very much the same thing I felt when I drank a little too much. You know, oh man, I didn't intend to get this drunk, and now I am. I think the big difference for me there is, when I had a negative experience like that with gambling, I just had to stay out of the casino for a few weeks until I recovered my money. And there was this physical barrier between me and my ability to gamble. When I graduated from college, I moved back home, and you know, I was looking for a way to reconnect with my friends who were very much into sports, more so than me. And I started gambling on sports. I placed my first bet for $5 or $10 on the Golden State Warriors with, you know, my friends in a bar. And it was the first time that I really felt that kind of connection and being one of the guys sitting around watching a sports game. But very quickly for me, in the course of, you know, a few months, I went from $5 or $10 on, you know, a game that I was watching socially to gambling by myself on my phone on games and sports that, you know, I wasn't even watching or knowledgeable about. And unlike my experience playing poker, there was no physical barrier. I could gamble 24 hours a day. I could gamble secretly. I could gamble when I was on the bus, when I was at home, when I was at work. And I did, you know, I would say about 6 months after placing my first sports wager, I was, you know, running my life around which games were televised and how I could stay in action. And all of this for me was, you know, I didn't think about it in a negative way, right? I thought of this still as just a financial problem. And I had started my career. I was working in the tech industry. I was making good money. And so as I kept making more money, you know, I would use my disposable income towards gambling. And I thought, it doesn't matter if I'm gambling or traveling or going out with friends. This is my disposable income, and this is my leisure activity. Well, pretty soon, you know, it became $200 a week, and then $500 a week, and then $1,000 a week. And as I kept gambling, I kept losing because, you know, no matter how much I won, I would always gamble with it again until I would lose. And I started to feel really bad about what was happening. I started to realize, man, this isn't something that I'm doing because I enjoy it. I don't even really feel good when I'm doing this anymore. I am just compelled to do this. And as I kept losing money, I started to feel really ashamed of what I was doing. And because it was a secret for me, I started to feel really fraudulent, right? I would have this success that was external. In my career, I would get a promotion, or, you know, in my social life, I would have a girlfriend, and my friends and my family would say, wow, man, you're doing great. You know, you must be so proud. And internally, I would just feel like this huge kind of, you know, disconnect between my outward appearance and how I felt about myself internally. I felt like, if only you understood, you know, what I felt like.
We have just about a minute before our break here. I want to get this one last question in for you. Again, just about a minute here. Do you have other addictions, or did you grapple with other addictions?
Yeah, you know, I didn't before I started gambling. But as I continued to gamble and I continued to feel shame and feel isolated, I started to drink more. And, you know, my drinking started to become a problem. And really, that is ultimately what led people to find out that there was something going on with me. The gambling was always secret.
All right, let's leave it there. We're going to be back after the break. You've been listening to our guest, Sam DeMello, someone who grappled with online gambling addiction as well as a gambling addiction in general. Sam will stay with us for another segment here on WJR Afternoons. It's our series, All In, Online, On the Hook. We'll be right back. Stay with us. All In, Online, On the Hook, our series on online gambling in the state of Michigan continues. We've been talking this afternoon with Sam DeMello, someone who's grappled with an online gambling addiction. He's here to talk about his experience and how he got well, how he managed to overcome this addiction. Sam, you talked about the stigma, the shame, how you went from gambling, starting when you were 12, like $5, 10, 20 bucks here and there, up to $1,000 a week gambling. What was this doing to your life in general, to your relationships?
Yeah, more than anything, it was just isolating me from everybody that I knew. It was causing me to kind of go deeper and deeper inside myself and feel less and less worthy of love and affection and, you know, the attention of other people. I think that that is the number one outcome of kind of the most devastating outcome of a gambling addiction, is that level of isolation.
How did you ultimately get help?
Yeah, I first tried going to therapy, and I went to a counselor that did not specialize in gambling addiction, but just specialized in, you know, general addiction. And I think that this is something that's really tricky, because gambling is a very different, you know, beast when it comes to addictions. They wanted to talk about my, you know, traumatic childhood and what I must be using gambling to escape from. And as that was not my background, you know, I'm a very privileged guy with a really supportive, you know, family. I found that really ineffectual. And then they recommended that I go to Gamblers Anonymous, which is the most common peer support group. And I walked into my first meeting and I said, you know, I'm Sam. I have this gambling problem. I'm gambling on my cell phone with cryptocurrency, you know, at my tech job. And most of the people around the room were 20 or 30 years older than me, and they had been in recovery for a long time, and they were telling stories about being at the horse track in the 80s.
Wow.
And I felt like, man, these people don't, you know, understand me. So I had a really hard time getting help through the kind of traditional means. Ultimately, how I got into recovery was my fiance gave me an ultimatum, you know. We had gotten engaged. She, you know, maybe 2 months after our engagement, she came to me and she said, I don't know what is happening with you, but you need to tell me what's going on. 90% of the time, you're this great guy who I love, and 10% of the time, you're totally unrecognizable. Either tell me what's happening or we're not going to get married. And at that point, I made a really conscious decision. You know, I was either going to tell this woman and quit gambling for good, and if I couldn't, you know, if I chose the gambling over her, then I was going to take my life. You know, I really got to that kind of point of desperation. And I got lucky, you know, I opened up to her. It was the first time I really broke my isolation, and she was super supportive and helped me understand, you know, the resources that were available. We started learning a lot more about gambling addiction and how it affects your brain, and, you know, how I started to see this as something that I was grappling with rather than, you know, something that was a moral failing on my side, which I think a lot of people that struggle with gambling feel that way.
Now, we talked about, if I can interrupt here, we talked how you, this was a gambling addiction. That's how it started. But what we really are focusing on here is this issue of online gambling, because since Michigan legalized online casino and sports betting in 2021, the state reports the calls to the gaming hotline have more than tripled. So what is it about being able to gamble on your phone or laptop that accelerates the problem of gambling or problem gambling?
Yeah, I think that there's a number of things. I think the first is it's just accessible 24 hours a day. There is no barrier that you can place between you and your ability to gamble. And while you can use responsible gambling tools and you can do things like I've done, exclude myself from specific websites that I used to gamble with, there is always another casino, whether it is regulated or offshore. You are in the casino 24 hours a day. I think the second piece is that these operators, these gambling companies online, are using all of the technology that social media and other, you know, big tech corporations use to make the gambling experience feel personal and engaging and to keep people gambling. They know everything that you are doing as a gambler. They know when to send you that bonus to re-engage you after you've lost a little too much. They know when to introduce you to a sport that maybe you've never gambled on before. So the odds are really stacked against you as the modern gambler when gambling online.
Oh, I did not know that they targeted the ads in that way.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the amount of data and analytics that these, you know, companies have to really understand someone's betting behavior and their betting patterns and the time of day at which they are most likely to engage in gambling is absolutely mind-blowing.
As you know, we've only got a couple minutes left here, and I definitely want to get back to the fact that you are well now. You've done a lot of work. You are well now. And you founded an organization called Evive back in 2023. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so I was looking for a way to give back to the problem gambling community. I knew that there were a lot of people that were suffering from gambling addiction and gambling harm like I had been for over a decade. And just like we were talking about, I saw on the side of the gambling operators all of this technology being used to make gambling, you know, engaging and accessible. But on the public health side of things, the people that were helping folks, you know, experiencing harm from gambling, I saw this very kind of analog model of call 1-800-GAMBLER if you have a problem. And I know that myself, as a young person, I don't call anybody, right? I'm very loath to pick up the phone. So I founded Evive as a digital solution to this digital problem. We partner with states and public health organizations across the country to modernize and digitize their approach to problem gambling, try to reduce the stigma, make it easier for people to seek help and seek to understand their relationship with gambling, and then connect them with the resources and the tools that they need.
How can people find Evive?
Yeah, you can find us at getevive.com, or you can download our app for free in the United States on the iOS and Google Play stores. It's E-V-I-V-E.
Right. I was just going to spell that out for our listeners, E-V-I-V-E. So if someone you know has an issue, you can go there. And we also want to say, we've been repeating this over and over, Sam, throughout the series, and that is that most people can have fun gambling, and most people can make a few bets and have a good time and move on. But for the people who are trapped the way you were and the people that you help, it is vitally important that they get the help that they seek. Sam DeMello, thank you so much for joining us today here on WJR.
Thank you very much for having me.
And it's 1-800-GAMBLER, 1-800-GAMBLER. That's the state's primary problem gambling helpline if you or somebody you know needs the help. We'll be right back here on WJR Afternoons with Chris Renwick. I'm Marie Osborne sitting in. And we are back. Steve Courtney, senior sports analyst, joining us here at the desk. Steve, I guess there's a hockey game. Everybody's talking about this hockey game.
Yes, yes, there is a little hockey game tonight. Marie, always a pleasure. Hello again, everyone. This chat brought to you by the Performance Remodeling Sweepstakes. Performance Remodeling selected Cameron Zakaria as the winner of their first annual $100,000 Window of Opportunity Sweepstakes. Performance Remodeling says, let's do it again. Log into windowsroofingsiding.com to enter to win the next sweepstakes from Performance Remodeling. Yeah, it would be nice if we were able to discuss the Four Nations Face-Off Championship tilt tonight in Baston. But of course, when you've got these days, the United States and Canada getting together, which, by the way, the greatest rivalry in international hockey, bar none. There's also some political sidebars going on.
No kidding.
And aside from the game itself, both the United States and Canada were talking about who on this game day. That would be President Donald Trump. The president, indeed a topic of conversation for both teams today, with a lot of Team USA players speaking about the call they shared with the president, with Team Canada sharing some of its thoughts about our president. Here's one of the quotes. It was awesome. It was one of the cooler experiences I've had. This is Team USA's Vincent Trocheck saying of the president's phone call. Having the president of the United States call your team about a hockey game just seems kind of crazy, but it's pretty cool. Then Team USA and New York Ranger forward JT Miller, he chimed in. Pretty cool. It was so awesome to hear the support. It's a pretty big deal for us to take time out of his schedule to talk to us. It's just another one of those things where we're pinching ourselves this tournament. It's been really fun so far to see the support from everybody up to the president. It's pretty wild. And then Miller said that Trump told the team to enjoy the moment and have fun with it. A reporter would later ask JT Miller if the president mentioned making Canada the 51st state.
Of course.
The reply, I don't think he brought that up. He left that one out. However, let the records indicate, and it's interesting, we got a call on the album show yesterday from one of our valued listeners who was under the impression that this whole 51st state thing is a joke. Let me say this. Trump wrote on Truth Social earlier today that he planned on calling Team USA, which he did, while later adding that on toward victory tonight against Canada will someday, maybe soon, become our cherished and very important 51st state.
Don't you think he's getting a charge out of watching people go bananas over this?
I would imagine so. Look, this is what I guess we've come to know and expect from our beloved president, that he is going to push the plunger, set the detonation, and then look around and say, what happened? What's going on? You know, I think the sad thing is, if we can just put our cards on the table, we have been allies with Canada.
Oh, yeah.
For a
long Absolutely.
Time. They have been by our side in World War I, World War II, other things of this nature. And for it to be where it's at right now is a little bit sad. Then you put on top of that the whole tariff situation. So, you know, what is going to come of this at this juncture? All I know is there's a hockey game tonight. Now, you go back to last Saturday night when it was at the Bell Center in Montreal. Yeah, the political aspect was in place because the Canadians booed our national anthem. But there was also some Americans booing theirs.
Yeah.
Which is tragic in and of itself.
Yeah.
So the question is, with it moving to Boston tonight, will the anthems be booed? One way or the other, I think, unfortunately, you can pretty much count on it.
Yeah, you can pretty much. You talk about this long and storied rivalry between the United States and Canada when it comes to hockey. When I was growing up, my father, we had many friends in Canada, and whenever the Wings would play any Canadian team, especially Toronto, but whenever they played a Canadian team, he would buy a block of tickets and they would come over and we'd all go to the hockey game together and watch the game.
Well, and this is interesting to point out. The United States has not won a best-on-best international tournament in 29 years. As a matter of fact, since the 1996 World Cup of Hockey.
Oh, wow.
Canada, meanwhile, has won 5 of the last 6 and 9 of 13 since the 1976 Canada Cup, including, I'll add, 3 in a row. I think if you're a fan of Team USA, and by golly, I think you are, take note because it looks like the injury situation might be a little bit better than anybody thought going in, with the exception of Charlie McAvoy. He has already been ruled out for the tilt tonight. The Boston Bruins saying the defenseman was admitted to Massachusetts General Hospital just this past Monday to undergo testing related to an upper body injury. That's going to be a huge loss. He's a hell of a defenseman. The Tkachuk brothers, Matthew and Austin, looks like they're going to be able to go. And according to Mike Sullivan, the coach of Team USA, Austin Matthews, should be good to go as well. Now, that being said, Canada is going to get a little shot in the arm as well because we find out that one of their top defensemen, Cale Makar, who is actually a Colorado a stinking Avalanche, but a heck of a young player, 57 games played with the Avs, 22 goals, 41 assists. He was not able to go in that tilt last Saturday in Montreal for Team Canada. He will be good to go tonight. And Canada's coach, John Cooper, says he is a star. He is a difference maker.
Oh, I like that, a difference maker. Do they give awards for that in hockey?
No, because you have to make a difference to actually get the award. But I know I'm looking for. I've enjoyed this Four Nations face-off. It took the NHL All-Star Game off the grid, which I applauded.
And it just put this whole thing in a whole nother stratosphere.
And there's been some really, really fun hockey to watch. And we're going to have Joe Valeno with the Winged Wheelers on the album show coming up. He's Quebecois. He's from Quebec. He's Canadian.
What is this language you are speaking?
You know, I watched so much hockey on Hockey Night in Canada when I was a kid. I knew not only the Star Spangled Banner, but I also knew the Canadian National Anthem. I can sing it word for word. You want to?
No. Because we might boo you, but we're not booing the actual anthem. We'd be booing you.
But there was nothing better than Hockey Night in Canada, for crying out loud.
That was always a big... We always watched
that. You know, John Cooper, who is actually the head coach of the Lightning and a fine human being, coaching Canada, you know, he was asked about this whole 51st state thing. And he says, well, you know, I think the good thing would be we'd have a hell of a hockey team.
So now, there you go, right? So there's the upside of all of it.
But you know what? Both these sides want to represent their countries and play to the best of their abilities. And you know, we'll see what happens. I want to see the hockey aspect.
So and the fights, of course, because they're legendary.
Well, there were three and 9 seconds in the first time they met Saturday night.
As a mother of two boys, I mean, that was a typical dinner hour at our house. So, you know, three fights in 9 seconds, that's nothing. My boys had that down and pat in no time.
Well, you know, as parents, you were like the officials last Saturday night. Just let them go.
No, we had a penalty box in the dining room. That's what we had. Yeah, we had a penalty box. All right, Steve Courtney, thank you so much for joining. Can't wait for the game tonight. I know you'll be all about it tonight. Ken Brown, Steve Courtney, up next, of course, with the Mitch Albom Show right here on WJR. I'm Marie Osborne for Chris Renwick on WJR Afternoons. I'll be back tomorrow. Have a great afternoon.